content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include, Could This State Move Put the Brakes on the Durham Orange Light Rail Project? And How to Apply for the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Fix-It Fund. And we'll begin with, Could the State Move Put the Brakes on the Durham Orange Light Rail Project? A revised state budget could bring the region's long-sought $3.3 billion Durham Orange Light Rail project to a halt. The budget, released Monday night, would require Go Triangle and Durham and Orange counties to have all the local and federal money for the light rail project before seeking state funding. The problem is the federal grant program, expected to pay for half of the light rail project's cost, requires them to have a commitment for all the local and state money. The 17.7-mile light rail line could have 18 stations running from UNC hospitals in Chapel Hill to Duke and NC Central Universities in Durham. The cost for building the light rail line includes $2.47 billion for construction and roughly $830 million in interest on debt. The federal government is expected to pay just over $1.2 billion, with another $247 million from the state. Go Triangle officials have said not getting the money from either government could stop the project, which is in the North Carolina Department of Transportation's evaluation process now. Republican leaders expect to bring the revised budget to a vote this week. If enough Republicans vote for the revised budget, it could pass and survive any veto from Democratic Governor Roy Cooper. The budget changes are disappointing. Go Triangle General Manager Jeff Mann said Monday night. He noted that the light rail project has been scored favorably twice by the state. We are assessing next steps, but the amended budget certainly appears to be detrimental to the light rail project because federal law requires a commitment of 50% in state, local, and other funds before the Federal Transit Administration commits the other half for any large transit project in the United States, he said. The light rail project is more than halfway through the federal engineering and final design phase and could be submitted later this year for full funding in 2019 from the federal New Starts program. The local funding for the project includes a half-cent sales tax and vehicle registration and car rental fees. Current plans call for construction to begin in 2020, with the rail service starting in 2028. Durham Democrat NC Senator Floyd McKissick Jr. tweeted late Monday night that the state budget had, in three lines, placed in jeopardy the future funding of the light rail system between Durham and Chapel Hill, which has broad support. We will lose $1.2 billion in federal funds and 20,000 jobs as a result of this change. Durham Democrat NC Senator Mike Woodard tweeted that it was a classic catch-22. Zach Hawkins, who won the Democratic primary for retiring NC Representative Mickey Michaud House seat, retweeted McKissick's comment with hashtag Save Light Rail. This is not the first time the state legislature has put financial hurdles in front of the light rail project. The original light rail plan in 2012 expected the state to pay 40% of the project's construction cost, and in 2013, the legislature passed the Strategic Transportation Investment Law. That law led the NCDOT to think about how to use state money more efficiently for statewide and regional projects while providing flexibility to meet local needs. The resulting strategic mobility formula decides which projects get into the 10-year state transportation improvement program. The project scored well in that process, Go Triangle officials said, with the state proposing $138 million for the first 10 years of the project in 2015. However, state lawmakers repealed the funding commitment later that year and capped state funding at $500,000. The legislature lifted the cap in June 2016, but limited state funding for any light rail project to 10% of the cost. The 10% cap faced a challenge last year in the House, but the Senate didn't go along with the change. The project received another high score from the NCDOT earlier this year, making it potentially eligible for up to 10% funding. And next, are you eligible for the Federal Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program? Worried that you may have ended up in a disqualifying loan repayment plan? The rules for a new fix-it fund are now clear, but you may have to wait a while to find out if there will be any money left for you. 2 months ago, Congress set aside $350 million to help public servants who had spent years making student loan payments only to find that they were not correctly repaying their loans. The bill gave the Federal Department of Education 60 days to come up with a plan for distributing the money. On Wednesday, the department added a page to its website explaining how the Fix-It Fund, which it refers to as the Temporarily Expanded Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, will work. One crucial point, you can't even apply for the money until you've completed 120 monthly payments and then been rejected for forgiveness by the department's loan servicer because you repaid your loans in an incorrect fashion. Confused yet? So is nearly everyone who has ever enrolled in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. So let's back up a bit. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program dismisses any remaining balance free of income taxes on the forgiven debt for any decade-long public servant, all government and most nonprofit employees, who meet three additional criteria. First, those 120 payments have to be on time and in the exact amount due. Second, you need to have the right kind of loan. Only federal direct loans qualify, not Perkins loans or the old federal family education loans, or FFELs, as they are known in education circles. Nothing about the Fix-It Fund changes any of this. The third criterion is where there is now some wiggle room. You're also supposed to be in the right kind of repayment plan during those 120 months, namely one in which your payment depends on your income and thus fluctuates each year depending on what you can afford to pay. Many borrowers got bad advice from loan servicers about enrolling in repayment plans and ended up in graduated or extended repayment plans that were supposed to be ineligible. So now comes the Fix-It Fund. It could allow some of the people who were in a list of formerly ineligible repayment plans into the loan forgiveness program if they apply for the exception before the $350 million runs out, or after Congress allocates more money, if that ever happens. Only people who paid more than they would have under an income-driven repayment plan on their most recent monthly loan payment and the one 12 months ago, and thus were consistently overpaying in effect, will be eligible. If this sounds like it applies to you, you need to do the following things in the following order. First, you need to make 120 on-time payments in the right job with the right loan. You can't go looking for relief yet if you've made only 90 payments, even if you already know that 30 of them 5 or more years ago were in the wrong repayment plan. Then, you need to ask Fed Loan, your servicer, to begin formal forgiveness proceedings. It will then reject you for being in the wrong repayment plan for part or all of that 120-month period. Only once that happens can you apply for the money by sending an email to Fed Loan. The address is on the Department of Education's website. The department has a template there that you can follow. The big unknown here is how long the money will last. It does create a bit of an odd situation for borrowers where they are competing for a limited pot of funds, but the finish line is years out and they have no idea who else is going for it, said Ben Miller, a former Education Department senior policy advisor, who is now senior director for the post-secondary education at the Center for American Progress. I asked Education Department spokesman if it might create a countdown clock or scoreboard to track the number, but did not receive a reply. The drawdown rate may also turn on an accounting question, according to Betsy Mayett, founder of the Institute of Student Loan Advisors. Consider someone who was in the wrong repayment plan for 3 of the last 10 years and has a $20,000 balance. Will the department use the Fix-It Fund money to pay for all of that $20,000 and every dollar of every forgiven balance from everyone who taps into it? Or will it use the fund to pay only the incremental cost of granting borrowers relief under this particular exception? For instance, that borrower with the $20,000 balance might have had a lower balance 3 years later, and if the Fix-It Fund pays just the difference between the two balances, it's a lot less than paying all of the $20,000. If the fund pays only that difference, the fund will last longer. That's a lot of ifs, maybes, and calculations, something that few people in any corner wish to have more of in a program that is already confounding. But for borrowers who would have paid tens of thousands more through no fault of their own without the fix, the added complexity is a whole lot better than the status quo. And next, FDA approves drug to control life-threatening bleeding in patients with liver disease. Dova Pharmaceuticals received federal approval Monday for a first-of-its-kind drug to control life-threatening bleeding in people with chronic liver disease. The Durham startup plans to start selling the medication named Doptelet next month. The pill is designed for chronic liver patients who are planning a minor medical procedure that could cause severe bleeding, such as a tooth extraction, a biopsy, or colonoscopy. Dova said about 70,000 people with chronic liver disease have a low platelet count and can't form blood clots. They are at risk of uncontrolled bleeding, and many require platelet transfusions on the day of a medical procedure, exposing them to the risk of infection and other complications. The company estimates the potential value of the medication at $2.5 billion. A patient's cost for a 5-day dose has not been announced, but Dova will offer introductory discounts and free samples. Dova still needs to work out reimbursement deals with commercial insurers, but the all-in cost of a platelet transfusion, including side effect management, is about $9,000, said Kevin Lullabert, Dova's senior vice president of product development. Like all drug developers, Dova also has to convince doctors, in this case liver specialists, at more than 100 liver transplant centers to use the newly approved medication with their patients. One challenge of being the first medication approved is you have to try to alter what the doctor has been doing, usually with some success, for 3 or 5 or more years. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration had put the medication generically called avatrombopag on priority review and approved it Monday. The drug stimulates platelet production and is the first such treatment approved for chronic liver disease patients awaiting medical procedures. Dova was formed in 2016 and now has 120 employees, nearly half of whom work in Durham, the rest in sales around the country. Doptelet had been in development for about a decade under several pharmaceutical companies and was acquired in 2016 from Japanese drug maker Eisai by Charlottesville, Virginia-based PBM Capital Group for an undisclosed price. PBM then spun off Dova to develop the drug through commercialization, and Dova now owns the worldwide rights to Doptelet. The company issued publicly traded shares last June, raising about $75 million, and raised another $80 million from another public stock offering in February. On Monday, trading in Dova stock was temporarily halted, pending news of the FDA approval. Once trading resumed, shares jumped to $28.51, but ended the day at $24.16, down 13.20%. Doptelet is taken once a day for 5 days before a medical procedure, after which time the patient must wait 5 to 8 days for the platelet count to increase. Taking Doptelet continuously would expose chronic liver disease patients to a risk of developing internal blood clots. Doptelet has side effects on up to 10% of patients. The side effects include fever, abdominal pain, nausea, headache, and fatigue, according to the company. Two other drug makers, GlaxoSmithKline and Amgen, make a medication for patients with low platelet counts, but those patients don't have chronic liver disease and take the medications for extended periods of time. Dova said it plans its next plans to seek approval for Doptelet to be used for non-liver patients like the GSK and Amgen medications. And next, after Amazon Echo misfire, here are ways to protect your privacy. Revelations that an Amazon Echo smart speaker inadvertently sent a family's private conversation to an acquaintance highlight some unexpected risk of new voice-enabled technologies. According to Amazon, the fault was an unlikely series of inadvertent vocal cues that triggered the speaker, causing it to begin recording, and then led it to interpret subsequent conversation as a send message request. There's no way to eliminate these sorts of privacy risk short of unplugging entirely, but you can minimize the odds of unpleasant privacy surprises with these tips. First, kill the mic. Most smart speakers have a physical button to disable the microphone, so a private conversation can't be recorded to begin with. You can hit that when you're having sensitive conversations. The button on the Echo will turn red. Other devices have similar cues. It doesn't make sense to keep the mic disabled throughout the day, though. If the Echo can't hear you, it won't be able to order you more toilet paper or play smooth jazz. Next, limit the mic. Disabling the microphone isn't practical on a smartphone, but you can limit what apps have access to it. Go to the settings and turn off mic access to all but essential apps, such as voice recorders or video conferencing. Netflix doesn't really need voice access. You can simply type the name of the show you're searching for. Next, about that camera. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg famously puts a piece of tape over his laptop's camera to prevent spying if anyone were to hack his device. Buy yourself a roll or use bandages. If you have a home security camera that's connected to the internet, turn the camera to the wall when you're home. Just remember to turn it back before you leave, or you defeat the point of having a security camera. Next, block the signals. For smartphones and other gadgets, you carry with you a Faraday bag that blocks electromagnetic waves, and that can help prevent unwanted spying. The good ones will block cellular and other signals, meaning privacy-compromising information such as your location won't leak out either. Just remember, your phone won't get any calls while it's in the bag, and that's the whole point. And then finally, be informed. Apple, Samsung, and other tech companies have worked over the years to ensure that their products work out of the box without users having to pore through lengthy manuals and operating instructions. The downside is that users are often unaware of all the things their gadgets can do, good or bad. Checking the reputable online reviews, how-to guides, and even instructional videos will help you get the most out of new technologies. They'll also tell you about any known glitches and risk. Of course, the safest approach is not to buy a new gadget in the first place. That might not be practical for smartphones these days, but do you really need a smart speaker or a television set that's connected to the internet? As it turns out, it's actually difficult to buy a TV without smart capabilities these days, but nothing says you have to connect it at home. And next, report urges state to study leasing buildings. State leaders could study leasing or selling aging government office buildings in downtown Raleigh, one of several proposals in draft legislation aimed at cutting cost and improving efficiency at the NC Department of Administration. The recommendations were part of a report from the legislature's Program Evaluation Division, which included a draft bill that could be considered during this year's short session. The report found that state-owned downtown buildings have nearly $100 million in deferred maintenance projects, and that many of the employees who work downtown could just as easily do their jobs in cheaper, leased space outside the city center. It says that property in downtown Raleigh has reached unprecedented values due to the surge in residential, commercial, and retail development, and that the current inventory of state-owned property may no longer be cost-effectively contributing to the state's goals and objectives. It suggests that the square footage of office space per employee could be reduced. The draft bill approved by the Joint Legislative Program Evaluation Oversight Committee would start small, calling for a consultant to conduct a business case analysis to reduce facility management cost and generate additional revenue through the sale or lease of the old revenue building. That 1920s era building sits at the corner of Morgan and Salisbury Streets and houses several state agencies, including the State Auditor and Department of Labor. Legislators and State Auditor Beth Wood voiced frustrations about the lack of accurate data on state office buildings. There's limited information available about how many employees work in each building, and the PED report included inaccurate information that indicated many buildings hadn't been renovated since the 1970s or 80s. A lot of the data has been incomplete, inaccurate, and unreliable, Wood said. That is not in any way related to the current secretary we have, but it is certainly related to years of inaccurate data coming out of the Department of Administration. Secretary of Administration Michelle Sanders said her agency is reviewing state property issues under legislation passed in 2016. We need to have a plan that is comprehensive and promotes smarter use of our state property, she said. Representative Craig Horn, a Union County Republican, said hiring an outside consultant to look at the property issue could provide a more objective look. We don't have a track record of changing ourselves very well from the inside, he said. Downtown Raleigh state buildings were a top priority for former Governor Pat McCrory, who proposed a Project Phoenix initiative to partner with the private sector to renovate buildings and add housing and retailing around the government complex. The issue has gotten less attention since McCrory left office in 2016, but aging offices continue to have structural problems. The Office of State Budget and Management is moving out of the top floor of the administration building because a roof replacement project was needed. The Program Evaluation Division report also looked at other potential cost savings at the Department of Administration. One finding was that 20% to 30% of state-owned parking spaces aren't fully used because many state workers have reserved spaces that are often empty. Switching to unreserved spaces, the report found, could allow the state to lease out unused space. The draft bill also calls on the consultant to study that possibility. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you've enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.